Hello and welcome to the show. I am Peter Whittle. Now, before I introduce this week's guest, just a notice about an upcoming event which is happening this Tuesday. As you know, our locals events have really been going great guns. We've had four in the last week alone. But we have an inaugural one coming up this Tuesday in Southampton. Tuesday, Southampton, that's the 19th, therefore, of March. It's in the evening, it's totally free. So if you're in Southampton or in the roundabout area and you'd like to come along, do come along. It'd be great to meet you. I'll be there. And they usually are great fun, these events. So if you want to find out more, particularly about where it is, then please do write to locals at newcultureforum.org.uk. Now, obviously, you'll be well aware that on our channel, in this program and other programs, the issue of free speech has been one of the dominant themes of our discussions and debates. And what's happening at the moment is there's a piece of legislation that's sort of going through the legislature in Ireland, which has been called by some critics one of the most serious attacks on free speech in the West. So I'm delighted that my guest this week is Lorcan Price. Thank you for coming, Lorcan.
Thank you.
Lorcan is a barrister and he is counsel also for the Alliance for Defending Freedom and something of a free speech specialist in many ways, I suppose. Lorcan, this piece of legislation, or it's not quite yet, a bill with a very long title, it has been covered in the news here, but what is it that is so pernicious about it?
Well, there are a number of things that are pernicious about it, Peter. Quite frankly, Ireland has already in place a hate speech law adopted in the late 1980s. So in a similar way to the United Kingdom when you had the Race Relations Act and the stirring up offences that were introduced here. And it has been rarely used. In the last 20 years, I was looking at this, there have been 40 prosecutions. It's around two a year. And that's notwithstanding the fact that during that period, Ireland became a major net recipient of migration of people. So for most of the existence of the Irish state, it has been the other direction, the flow. Irish people left for the United States, the United Kingdom, Europe, Canada, and so on. And then around the late 90s, 97, 98, for the first time, we had people arriving in from Europe, of course, Eastern Europe, Nigeria, other places in sub-Saharan Africa and the Middle East. And Irish people responded quite well to that. The numbers were relatively small initially, and people were integrating well. And even though we had in place a piece of legislation to deal with, among other things, racist hate, it was rarely used because of the, by and large, very stable, friendly community relations, and no small part played by Christian churches in fostering that environment. However, things have changed recently, particularly since the Ukraine war started, and our government pursued, I think it's fair to say, a reckless policy of essentially open border. The one minister made the statement in the parliament that Ireland was, quote, a safe harbour for anyone fleeing persecution from anywhere in the world and for any reason. So that was in response to a question as to whether or not he could conceive of any cap on numbers, bearing in mind the actual physical infrastructure of the state and its ability to take people. So the policy of the government was maximal, as many people could come in as they wished. And sure enough, that led to the consequence of large numbers of people arriving. I think in the first year, over 100,000. So that's 2022, 2023, and then another 100,000 the following year. And not just Ukrainians, there was a major rise in the number of what they call international protection applicants. This is asylum seekers from outside the European Union, again, mainly from the Middle East, North Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. And the government's response to this was initially to lecture the population about the need to be welcoming and to open our hearts. And we had a history of migration, so we should accept people coming into the country. Something, as I pointed out, Irish people did quite well for many years before that. And then the response was to deny there was a problem, to suggest that there was physical capacity to take people and they could continue to come. And then finally, the response was to condemn and criticize any community groups that were opposing large numbers of people being without consultation, placed in local hotels and community centres and so on. So a very similar pattern, I think, it would be fair to see, as we've seen, not just here, but across the West. In parallel with this, we have a government that decided that it was going to transpose a piece of European legislation, that is a directive in relation to xenophobia and Holocaust denial and racism, a framework agreement from 2008. It decided to transpose this into law, and it created this legislation that you alluded to, which is the Incitement to Hatred rebooted. It has a long title, which is to do with hate crimes and incitement to hatred legislation. And that's not incidental. They were very clever in how they approached this. They took hate crimes, where you have sentencing enhancements for a motivation that is hatred against somebody for a protected characteristic, and hate speech, which is a totally separate thing.
Yes.
Because there's no crime having been committed there. And they mashed the two of them together to make it more difficult to comprehensively oppose this. So I think that was a deliberate policy choice, because that's not the way the law had been constructed prior to this particular piece of legislation. And so why is this particular legislation pernicious? Well, it's pernicious because, like many of these hate speech type offences across Europe, it lacks any definition of hate.
How can that possibly happen, Lord? How can you do something like that and not actually, you know, even attempt a definition of hate?
It's extraordinary. Yeah. They attempted one, which is hate is hatred, or any action creates hatred. So it's recursive.
Yes.
It relies on itself for its own definition, circular. And I would suggest to you that these type of offences are, or that this vagueness is a feature rather than a mistake or a bug. The intention is to keep people in a constant state of questioning as to whether or not they have transgressed the law and wandered into hatred. Mm. So at what point does your legitimate criticism about the number of people arriving into the country then move into racism, or incitement rather to racism, incitement to criticism of somebody on the basis of their nationality and so on? So if you can create a kind of an omnipresent sense that I could be breaking the law if I say something controversial, people are more likely to disengage from controversy, and to say nothing, the so-called chilling effect. And this is a very deliberate, in my view, intention. And I can say that with the authority of the Minister for Justice, because he was asked to define hatred and a definition was offered as an amendment. And he said, and I quote, I'm not going to do that because it would reduce the ability of the prosecution service to secure prosecutions. So they're quite clear.
It's completely out in the open.
There's no mystery about it. They want people to be prosecuted for speaking their mind on matters of controversy, and they want to keep people guessing as to whether or not something is in fact a hate speech. So that's the first element of it. And I think probably, particularly when you think of the common law principle, that the criminal law should be precise to allow people to be able to predict whether or not they're committing a crime. So the fact that it lacks that and relies on this circular definition, I think, is pernicious. There are other elements then that are very troubling, and that go way beyond what the European Union required. So there's an open-ended gender category. So the protected characteristics are defined, and the usual ones we've all come to know from equality law and hate speech law: race, nationality, age, religious belief, and so on, disability. But they've added one in addition to sex called gender.
Right.
So sex is a protected characteristic. You can't incite hatred against somebody on the basis of their sex. But they've created this new one called gender. And the position in Ireland in the law under the gender recognition identity legislation is that you can change your identity from male to female or female to male. And so in either sense, you'd be protected under the sex characteristic. But nobody's quite sure what the gender characteristic means, because it's not...
Do they go on to, like,
no,
do
they don't
sub-definitions or anything?
No.
No.
So it's open to interpretation as to what a gender-based offence could be. And I would speculate that it would include criticism of these kind of invented genders that we've seen, like trigender or two-spirit or questioning or demigirl or cat, any of this kind of nonsense. And even calling it nonsense then, of course, as well, would be regarded, if this law passes, as incitement, because you're attacking somebody's gender choice. So that's another element of it that's highly troubling. I think one that probably I would suggest provoked a lot of the international comment was the powers of search and seizure,
Well, yes, and also possession of material.
Possession of material, yes.
So possession of... So if you are suspected of possessing material, mm-hmm. you know, and what would surely they define material? I mean, what would that be? Would that be a book or something on your phone or what?
It could be all of those things. And it could be a text message where you've shared a joke. Mm. We saw a Belgian politician recently now who's got a year in jail for sharing memes and jokes on a private WhatsApp group.
Right.
It could be a picture. It could be, as you say, printed material. It could be a voice note and so on. So it's the possession of material is any material that could incite hatred. And again, we're back to the question, of course, of what is hatred. So the possession offences are, they already exist in the existing law, as I say, very rarely used. But the difference between a possession offence in 1989, when the previous legislation was introduced, is that if you were being accused of possession of material to incite hatred, you would certainly, from an evidential point of view, have to have the material there physically at some point. So if for example, if you were handing out pamphlets or books, the police would presumably look for a search warrant and then establish that you have stacks of these things and maybe a printing press or a photocopier and so on. The difference in the digital age that we're now in is having a single joke on your phone or a meme or any kind of picture and so on, the possessing one copy of that is in a sense the same concept of being able to possess with the intent to distribute, which is what they're criminalizing. So it could be very difficult to defend criminal proceedings where somebody has a joke or something on their phone that they didn't, number one, possess it, and then number two, intend to distribute it. And so the intention to distribute is the critical element. In the past, as I say, you would have to rely on let's say, physical evidence to show that that existed. Mm. But now, digitally possessing one copy of something would be enough, in my view, to secure a conviction.
And so distributing it, so what, do they... Where does the burden of proof lie there then?
Mm, well, that's a very good question, and that's another criticism I have. They've reversed the burden of proof. So the onus is on the accused now to show that they didn't intend to distribute. And so you find yourself in a position then, again, trying to defend yourself in court with one joke or one meme on your phone. Mm. The police have exercised their power of seizure and search, and the obligation on you is now to show that you didn't intend to distribute it. And I mean, the court can take any kind of inferences, as you can imagine, from the fact that you had it on your phone, or maybe you've already received it from somebody and you were preparing to forward it to somebody else and so on. So it's creating, again, just like the lack of a definition, a sense of unease at all times as to whether or not you're transgressing the law by merely sharing in matters of public controversy a joke or a picture or a meme or a controversial statement from a politician.
And what are the kind of, what are the, you know, what can you be in for? I mean, if you're found to possess this material, what are we talking about? You know, what are the sentences involved?
Well, on summary conviction, it's up to a year in our version of the magistrate's court. But on indictment, it can be up, depending on the severity or connections, either 2 years or 5 years. So there are serious sentencing powers here associated with it. So not only, of course, do you have to suffer the trouble of being possibly arrested, questioned, charged, and then prosecuted and having a criminal conviction recorded against you, which is why I never dismiss fines as being a serious burden on people as well. But you also have custodial sentences here, which are not insignificant. Mm. And we've seen recently custodial sentences in this country for somebody putting stickers up. And
that's right, 2 years.
Yeah, 2 years, yeah. Which I think is absolutely outrageous. Mm. So these laws are going to be used. The Irish government hasn't pushed through this legislation in vain. They intend to use it, and they intend to use it quite concretely, I think, in the first instance, in connection with the ongoing discussion around migration.
Well, isn't it right that Leo Varadkar sort of, not exactly brought it forward, but they started talking about this bill right in the middle of the disruption, just after Dublin, didn't they?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that shows you, I think, really, in the government's mind at least, where the connection is. Their view is that public disorder in relation to migration means that they need to crack down on critical commentary about migration. There's no lack of policing power or legislative options already in the criminal law for the police to prosecute people for hijacking and burning a bus or assaulting a police officer. So it's absurd to suggest that we need hate speech laws in order to deal with public disorder. But that's precisely what the government is pushing. And I think it, as I say, it shows the underlying concern here, which is that public criticism of the government's reckless migration policies now is meaning that there is probably the very social fracture that we've avoided in the past in Ireland. But the blame lies squarely in the government.
Yes.
The government's failure to plan for large numbers of people coming in, the government's failure to connect their open border policy with large numbers of arrivals. And then the government's latter concern, and this is where a lot of the tension in Ireland is around, is the increase in crime associated with migration. There have been a number of really tragic incidents in the country where non-Irish people have committed very serious offences.
Well, not least started the Dublin riots.
Precisely that. So that was a stabbing. Yeah. And I struggle to think of, in fact, there's no example I'm familiar with ever of children being stabbed on the streets of any Irish city or town by a stranger in this kind of way, a just random attack.
But yes, but in that case, if I remember, the Varadkar said essentially the people who were rioting, or the people who were protesting mm-hmm. about this before it became a riot, it was an Algerian guy,
correct.
Apparently, who stabbed these kids. Mm. He said, "You are the problem," didn't he, to the protesters? Mm-hmm. "You are the people we're frightened of, mm-hmm. not these." And I sort of. It's that level of, it's just quite unbelievable, that sort of level of condemnation of your own people, mm-hmm. actually, it seems to me.
I think it shows a degree of contempt, yes. frankly, for them. That's reflected in a number of statements from the government. Mm. First of all, to deny that there is a connection between migration and crime, mm. which Ireland would probably be unique then in Europe not to have that connection, because the data is clear from Belgium, from the Netherlands, from Sweden, that there's a clear connection between migration and crime. So the Irish government, first of all, will deny that that is the reality, and then pour scorn on anybody who prepares to talk about it.
Yeah.
There were a number of politicians, independent politicians, who attempted to have a debate about this in the parliament, in the lower chamber, in the Dáil, and they were subject to really trenchant, quite absurd, intemperate criticism from the government for even having the temerity to bring the debate forward.
Yes, yeah.
So the instinct is always to shut down the discussion, to censor it, to deny the reality of what's happening. And what we saw in Ireland was a grassroots community response to that. Mm. People in, generally speaking, working class areas of Dublin said, well, no, we have had a limit to the numbers of people we can accept. We are genuinely concerned about the policing issue, and the Irish police are very overstretched to begin with. Mm. We think that there's going to be an intolerable burden on resources, schools, local hospitals, doctors' appointments, and so on. And they pointed out quite legitimately that the wealthier parts of Dublin, which are mainly concentrated in the south of the city, have not had anything like the number of refugees placed in those areas. Mm. So the concentration has been to put them in rural small towns and villages around Ireland, or in Dublin in predominantly working class areas. Mm. And that hasn't gone unnoticed.
But you know, when you see people, you know, perfectly peacefully as well. I mean, you know, I watched a couple of documentaries recently, and people have been protesting about really quite large scale numbers of people, often into very small communities, like 5,000 people, suddenly taking thousands more.
Yes.
They obviously are being demonised, aren't they? But so basically what you're saying is that the hate speech legislation cannot be seen without this. It's certainly in tandem with. What is the position with it now, actually, Lorcan? I mean, is it sort of just making its way through, you know, the Irish Parliament as well?
Yes, so it's, at the moment it's before the Seanad, or the Senate, which is the upper house, which has, broadly speaking, it was modelled on the House of Lords, so it has similar powers to amend, but the amendment then has to be accepted by the lower house. So I believe the government intends to bring it back for its kind of subsequent debate phases, probably in the next month or two in the Senate, where there is the possibility it will be amended. And then it will go back to the Dáil, to the lower house, where, frankly, I remain to be convinced otherwise, but there's probably narrow enough to no chance that it will be amended there. It passed the Dáil with 120 out of 160 votes in favour of it. So it's not just the government parties that support this,
yes,
but you have the large opposition left-wing parties, including the Sinn Féin party, mm-hmm, which is pro-open borders, pro-hate speech. Yeah,
so it's quite openly open
borders. Oh, very much so, yeah, yeah. And that's notwithstanding the fact that all the polling shows that its voters are completely in the opposite direction, mm-hmm, when it comes to this issue. So there'd have to be a major change among the government parties and the opposition in the lower house and the Dáil, and I don't see that likely happening. But you know, the referendum result that I think we'll come to later change the dynamic there somewhat.
I was going to ask you that, but in the meantime, is there a fair amount of protest against this bill? I mean, outside of political parties, which, as you say, are all supportive?
Well, there's certainly criticism, and it's growing. I noted there that at the weekend after the referendum in Dublin, that a senior backbench, government backbench member of parliament called Willie O'Dea from County Limerick, he came out and said it's time to stop the woke agenda at the government, and that would include the hate speech law in his estimation. And I agree. So whether or not this growing criticism results in a change is difficult to see. Party loyalty is very strong in Ireland, and if you leave your party in a similar way here, you're kind of ostracised, and particularly with a general election coming up, being removed from the ticket and so on would be difficult for a lot of MP or TDs. So whether or not that decisively changes the calculation, I remain to be convinced, as I say.
Do you think that people's religious convictions in Ireland could be in jeopardy because of this bill? I mean, I think there was a case in Finland of a woman who, you know, had strong Christian convictions and fell foul, and I think actually was imprisoned, I believe. Mm. Right? I mean, are there sort of religious positions that could actually come under this bill?
Yes, is the answer. I'm also well aware of the case in Finland. I'm part of her legal team.
Oh, you are?
Päivi Räsänen, yes.
Oh, I see. Does that mean you can't talk about it?
Oh, no, I can talk about it. Yeah, we won at the first instance court, and we won at the Court of Appeal, and it's currently being appealed, if you can imagine this, to the Supreme Court by the prosecution, which they have the power to do in Finland, remarkably.
So I was wrong, she wasn't imprisoned.
So she's not imprisoned yet, but the statute provides for a prison sentence, although the prosecution is seeking a fine, but the court would have the power to imprison her, possibly. However, that case is ongoing, but I think it illustrates the point that you're making very well, which is that involved a lady. She was a former equivalent of the Home Secretary in Finland, a long-standing member of parliament. She criticised the Finnish Lutheran Church's support for the Pride Parade in Helsinki. And on that basis, she was prosecuted for hate speech, or their equivalent. And they dug up a number of things she'd written years previously and also included that in the charges. And you can readily foresee the same thing happening in Ireland with the legislation there, because an Orthodox Christian position, for example, would be to criticize gay marriage and to say, you know, marriage is between one man and one woman. It would be to criticize certain types of sexual behavior outside of marriage. Yeah. And would that mean then that sexual orientation, for example, that you're whipping up or inciting hatred against sexual orientation? There's no reason to think Ireland is different in this regard than Finland or other countries. And the high profile prosecution of members of parliament in Finland, we had a Catholic bishop in Spain who was threatened with prosecution, politicians in Belgium and others. People take from that then, well, if high-profile public commentators like that can be prosecuted, I certainly could as well as a simple member of the public. And therefore, it goes back to this whole problem associated with people self-censoring and being this chilling effect associated with these vague, overbroad laws.
I mean, the point you made earlier actually certainly applies in Britain, which is, you know, this idea of confusion. If you just don't know, it's best to keep your mouth shut.
Yes.
Which, so therefore, you know, it sort of almost does the job for itself, you know, by it's almost like a, like this idea of a kind of blasphemy law coming in Britain.
Yeah.
We don't have a blasphemy law, but the fact is that we've got a de facto one. You know, people just are not going to, in this case, criticize Islam if they think, for example, that
exactly.
they're against the war. You mentioned there the recent referenda, which was surely a blow to this extraordinary, because what we're talking about, surely, looking here, is this exactly the same as we've got here and across Europe, this kind of elite class who are entirely at odds with what the majority of people think on these things, and seem determined to kind of, you know, win the day. What's their reaction been to what were quite, you know, real trouncings, weren't they? I mean, there were two, weren't there?
That's right.
This was about the constitution, hence going to a referendum, right?
Correct, yes.
And as I understand it, there was one, obviously, about basically trying to expand the definition of marriage to be, I think, durable relationships.
That's right, yes.
Durable relationship. And the other one was supposedly sexist language about women's require duties in the home.
That's right.
Am I correct there?
Yes.
And these were resoundingly defeated, these attempts to change this. Well, first of all, I don't know, but that must have been, I mean, when I saw this, I thought, they're fighting back. Great, you know. But how was it, how did the ruling elites, you know, respond to this?
Well, I think it'd be fair to say with the same level of contempt that they've responded to the migration protests and other things. it's very interesting looking at the map of how the referendum went. Most of the country voted no, and as you correctly put it, overwhelmingly, other than a small enclave in South Dublin where the elite essentially find themselves living. So again, in a small country with a population around 4 million, Dublin is the significant centre of power, and then within Dublin, then it's the south side of the city where the kind of a liberal elite, or for want of a better term, are based. And there was a commentator in the 1980s called Desmond Fennell who put it quite well. He published a kind of collection of his writings called "Nice People and Rednecks," and they think of themselves as the nice people, and the rest of the country then as rednecks.
Yes.
And as far as they're concerned, institutionally they hold all the power. Media-wise, through all of these NGOs, lawyers, the media, I said already, politically, they hold a significant amount of power.
Yes, because these NGOs, non-government organisations, there's a particularly, well, quite a prominent one, is there, this is the National Women's Council.
That's right, that National Women's Council.
But the thing is that these things are entirely self-invented, aren't they? You know, where is their authority? Where does it derive from?
Well, it must be very gratifying for them to create themselves, give themselves a grandiose title like the National Council of whatever, and then find themselves invited to hobnob with ministers and create policy. Their authority derives from the weight that's given to them, frankly, by the same elite who are hearing what they want to hear and then agreeing with them. The difference, in one sense, of Ireland's trajectory into modernity, when you look at it in the context of the rest of Europe, is that we came late to the game, and that had a lot to do with the power of the Catholic Church. But there's something quite juvenile about the reaction, which is that everything connected to the church or the recent past has to be cast off. We have to liberate ourselves from that. And there's a narrative now that the Irish elite tell themselves, which is that we're kind of boldly stepping into the modern era, and the constitution and everything associated with that, that's the past. So, you know, terms like the mother's duty in the home, we have to discard all of that language and embrace something completely liquid and malleable, like durable relationships in the context of the other amendment. And there was a resounding no to that. Whether or not, with the exception of the small enclave that I mentioned, whether or not that has a broader impact remains to be seen. I think it probably has alarmed Sinn Féin to some extent, because their voters were the most strongly opposed to it, even though they campaigned as a party in favour of these amendments. And it would have alarmed Fianna Fáil as well, who are in a coalition government with Fine Gael. So these are the centrist parties. And their voters heavily went in towards a no vote as well. Will it mean something like the hate speech legislation is paused? I don't know. The ramifications of this are still working themselves out at the moment. I would hope that they would draw some kind of a lesson from the trouncing they received in the referendum. But the problem with the Irish elite, and the difference necessarily to here, is it's a smaller country with a smaller pool of kind of media class and chattering class, and it's very much a bubble. And they, I don't think they'll be willing to change trajectory. In some ways, I fear that they will double down. And they will feel resentful that their woke revolution is under threat, and they're going to try and arrogate more power to themselves. And so in that sense, they've already convinced themselves that the hate speech legislation is a critical part of stopping widespread criticism of their agenda. And I think they will see the referendum as another example that the country still has reactionary forces in it, and they just need to ensure that mis and disinformation are criminalized. There's a broader point that can be made here as well about the powers that the Irish state has given itself over recent years. There is an electoral commission as well that, unique in the Western world, now has the power to deal with mis and disinformation. There is a new agency called the Media Commission, or Commission na Mbean in Irish, that has enormous regulatory powers over online content. And this matters not just for Ireland, but all of Europe, because the headquarters of most of the large internet companies are in Dublin. So Meta, Facebook, LinkedIn, X, Twitter, and Google. So the legal framework in Ireland isn't just relevant for the citizens of Ireland, but actually has implications for what's posted here, France, Germany, and so on. And I think you will see that the Irish government is working in conjunction with the European Commission to use Dublin as a ground zero for censorship online, through this hate speech legislation, through the new media commissioner, through the Digital Services Act from the European Union. And so there's a much broader agenda going on here. And we saw during Brexit as well, the Irish government is perfectly happy to allow the country to be used as a foil for what Brussels wants to achieve.
Do you think that the Irish elite, I mean, do they just simply want to show that they are just like all these other European countries?
I think that puts it quite well. It's part of it, as I say, is a juvenile reaction to the recent past. I remember one occasion there was a leader of the Irish Labour Party, and he was on a kind of a talk show, and he was talking about his own youth and how he felt that his political mission, and I'm paraphrasing here, was to reject the values of his father. That kind of instinct, I think, is very prevalent in a lot of the so-called elite that I've met over the years, to kind of throw off what they felt were the restrictions of their parents in the past Ireland. So I think it's quite juvenile in that sense. But the other element of it certainly is wanting to align very closely with Europe and the European Union and the blob in Brussels. They derive a lot of personal and political satisfaction of being connected to something bigger than just a small country, of course, and being feted in Europe by the Commission and by others as being a modern, progressive country is a big part of that. I think Micheál Martin, who was the Taoiseach, the Deputy Prime Minister, and Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, the Prime Minister, both enjoyed the praise they received about the number of refugees they were taking in. That kind of element is certainly a major part of it, which in a sense, it's absurd to have to kind of even think of those things as being factors. But we know throughout this kind of woke revolution that swept the West, that signaling your virtue is a major driver, alas, of why we see these completely incoherent and in many cases, as I say, incoherent and contradictory policies. Like, Ireland wants to reach net zero, but it's importing, or it's allowing in, hundreds of thousands of people who all have to be housed and transported and fed and so on. And nobody pauses for a moment to say, well, the Green Party is in government and it wants the country to have a lower carbon footprint, but the same party and the same government is also bringing in more and more people all the time. So all to do with virtue signalling, I think.
Yes, I do think, I mean, here, on this, on a broader point, you know, but the protests against immigration, you know, a lot of people here look to Ireland and they sort of, they think the Irish are heroes. They sort of wish we had the same kind of protests here. I mean, the nearest I can think of was when people went to a hotel up in near Liverpool. And I think it was actually set on fire or something. But I mean, the point was is that immediately everyone connected to that protest was immediately far right.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
That's the way, that is the way it's always pans out.
Yeah.
You know? But I think people look across and they sort of think, well, God, they're really actually, you know, they're setting up and they're doing something. Why don't we, why can't we get to do this?
Yeah, that's interesting you say it. It's always interesting to see the perspective from outside the country. Yeah. Ireland is still has a relatively high social trust, so the communities are still quite stable. And
that's a good point, actually.
That's a critical element, I think, of it. So people do feel a sense of ownership over where they live and what's going on in their community, particularly as you move outside of Dublin. And so I think that certainly played a part. A lot of the concerns you hear are over consultation. We weren't consulted, we weren't addressed as a community, and we weren't told what was being brought in. People have no difficulty housing women and children, particularly those fleeing Ukraine. But on more than one occasion, the authorities have been caught fibbing about who is being accommodated.
Yeah,
they've been told women and children, and then sure enough, you know, young men who have had no vetting or have just arrived into the country are being placed in these communities, which is just bad for everybody involved. The other thing, though, I think it's probably relevant, particularly talking to an Englishman, is that Ireland, of course, has had a kind of a revolutionary history. Mm. A lot of the trouble between our countries in the past was as a result of that. I think that same instinct to be somewhat distrustful of authority or centralised authority is still there. And it's not hostility to the foreigner, because it's a very welcoming country. And there's a very large number of English people who've moved to moved to Ireland over the years and live there. And as I say, when the European Union expanded, there were a large number of people who arrived without any trouble whatsoever from Poland and Bulgaria and so on. The difference here is the speed of the change, the lack of consultation, and it has to be said, the undoubted connection between the rise in crime and serious criminal incidents and non-nationals.
Well, there are these sort of charts that kind of one sees, if nowhere else, on social media, which, you know, from different parts of Europe and also in this country, which shows this sudden, extraordinary leap in particularly violent crime and rape. And it's usually from around 2013, 14. And, you know, one leaves it at that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
You know, you say that there is a link. Well, obviously, one look, you know, people post these things, but they can't sort of say why this might be, because, you know, in fact, you've got to go look, haven't you, and find out what are the kind of, you know, what are the demographics, if you like, of this. But this is something which seems to be gathering sort of public awareness around it a bit.
That's why they want to shut it down.
Yes.
They as a general observation, and this has been a view of mine increasingly over the years, we're governed by, in virtually every Western country, by an elite, by a governing class that is addicted to nonsense, from net zero to open borders, to the hollowing out of the democracy, be it by increasingly allowing international institutions and courts to make decisions about policy. And I'm not entirely sure, you know, there are certain elements, of course, that there are certain commonalities between what's happening in Ireland and everywhere else. But I'm not entirely sure how they coordinate this, or even why, because it's so self-evidently harmful to the countries involved, to social trust, to economics. I mean, the Germans, Germany has seen its country enormously harmed by successive governments on energy policy, on borders and migration. And the only response of the German authorities, like the Irish authorities, is to crack down on criticism. So we're going to reach a point where that no longer yields the returns they're hoping
for. Well, yes, I was going to ask you this, because obviously you do a lot of international work, didn't you? You're working on this case in Finland too. And I just wondered, when it comes to, if we just give it to like the woke invasion, if you like, or the woke infestation and free speech, because they're obviously connected, do you see any lessening of the grip that they have or not really? It would be nice to say yes.
Yeah,
but the fact is, I sometimes think actually, you see, look, I look and think, oh, you know, actually, that's a very good thing. Or, you know, we've just had this decision here, for example, about puberty blockers. You might say, well, that's actually is all part of the same movement, isn't it?
It is. Space. Yeah,
and that's very good. But then, all other countries still allow it, and also we are apparently a bit of an outlier on this. You know, I mean, do you feel pessimistic or optimistic?
Well, I'm optimistic in the long run, but not in the short to medium. I don't think we've reached the height of the revolution yet. There hasn't been there will be a reaction against populism by the authority. I mean, Brexit, certainly there was a reaction against Brexit by the European Union. It convinced itself it even needed more power, and they tried to destroy the Brexit movement as much as possible with the various leave agreements. And there was a reaction against Trump. So when there's signs that the agenda, the deep unpopularity of the agenda translates into a public reaction, there's a counter reaction. And my hesitancy in the short to medium term is that the dominance that these people have over the institutions is extraordinary. And I certainly see this over my years working at the international institutions, be it the European Court of Human Rights, which you would expect, of course, the various parts of the United Nations, again, not surprising, and the European Union. But to take my own country then, and I think that's true of here as well, that the institutional capture continues then, obviously media, academia, the civil service, sporting organizations, unfortunately, schools, and increasingly churches, Christian churches. There will be a generational shift. There's a lot of evidence that Gen Z is more skeptical of some of these self-evidently absurd claims about gender, about the environment, about the fact that nations no longer seem to have borders, that we're all kind of single transferable economic units. So as that skepticism grows, in the long term, there will be changes. But in the short to medium term, the institutional power of this agenda is extraordinary. And it's going to take some time to unpick that. But the mistakes that they've made are certainly more and more evident. And I don't think there's any hiding the damage that's been done demographically, socially, economically, by a lot of these recent policies in Europe.
Well, I think that in terms of the puberty blocker decision, you know, that is a bit like taking quite a big brick out of a wall, isn't it? I mean, in a sense, you know, you can see how people might then start to look at the whole thing and say, well, wait a minute, that's obviously wrong. So this is wrong, that's wrong, this is wrong.
Yes.
But the thing is, in general, in this discussion, it requires great moral courage, doesn't it, to say, actually, well, maybe we were wrong. And the thought of any of these people, because I noticed actually with the referendum in Ireland, that when you had various senior politicians talking about why it happened, they weren't actually saying, well, because people didn't agree and that's democracy. It was almost sort of, well, they were badly influenced by the far right.
Yes, or they were confused, or there was misinformation.
The wording.
That's right, yes. Which, of course, had it gone the other way, there would be no suggestion whatsoever that anyone was confused. They were all perfectly clear. So, you know, but there's always that degree of hypocrisy. But what I think your point is well made, that particularly on gender, they reached a point of absurdity that it was hard to deny any longer that what was happening here was ideology over reality. And in sports, where you had clearly men, biological men, outperforming women, or in boxing and some other sports, physically assaulting women on a rugby pitch, dominating, pushing women aside and injuring them. The spectacle of that was so absurd that I think that's where the reaction might have started. I tend to think as well, COVID, the overreach around COVID. This country was a lot better than others, but it was, things were crazy in France and Germany, where I was based mostly during that whole episode. as it became clear that they were lying about various important things, about the effectiveness of masks, of the effectiveness of lockdowns, and so on, and lying about gender, as I say, people start to ask a lot of other questions. What else have we been misled on?
Yeah, yeah.
And I hope that will continue.
I think one of the most interesting points you've made, actually, you know, for me anyway, is that when I was sort of talking admiringly of the way that people have protested in Ireland, you said that there's still social capital. You see, and that's one thing that I think is really diminished in Britain. You know, it's just, it's one of the reasons why people appear to be sort of so atomized and actually not exactly passive, but sort of powerless in response to all of this. Thank you very, very much for that, for your time and everything.
Thank you, Peter.
I know you're a very, very busy man, but hope maybe you come up and speak to us again.
I'd be delighted to, yes. It'd be lovely. Thank you very much for inviting me.
When they hold the next set of referendum, which of course they will keep doing until they get the right answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this week, and we shall see you next time. Thank you. Bye. Hello. If you're enjoying the New Culture Forum channel and you believe in our mission, may I invite you to join our membership scheme at the link below or on our website, newcultureforum.org.uk. Our work is more important now than ever, and we have great plans ahead for the future, but we can't do it without your support. From as little as £3 per month, you can help ensure that we continue on our mission. As a member, you'll receive a range of benefits, including access to exclusive content, invitations to our private events, including here at our studios, free copies of our books, and much, much more, including, of course, our famous NCF mug. If you aren't able to become a member, then please help us by clicking this button and subscribing to our channel. It's completely free. Just remember to also click the bell icon so that you can get notifications when we post new videos. Thank you.